From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, February 12th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunavchi, Shawa, Toeksuknusum, Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, the Holi Festival celebration is happening in March, and you can get involved. We chat with Nimi Phillips about Bollywood dance and how you can help celebrate during the Holi Festival ceremony. AI is big business right now, and this year's Innovation Summit from the Juno Economic Development Council is all about it. We find out what's on tap for the summit, taking place on February 26th and 27th. And beginning Friday, it's the Great Backyard Bird Count. It's all to help scientists better understand and protect birds around the world. We chat with Brenda Wright from Juno Audubon Society about what you need to do to get involved. Those conversations, Tongass voices, and a rich tradition, coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-thru locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Ogg Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The Holi Festival ceremony is scheduled for March 24th here in Juno, once again organized by Nimi Phillips, owner of Spice Indian Cuisine, who joins me now in studio. Gunavchi, Shaigudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here again, Nimi. Wasaiti, how's it going?
Good, good. Thank you for having me, Boston. It's so nice to see you again.
Yeah, so let's start with the question, just to reset, right?
What is Holi?
What is Holi?
Holi Festival is a Hindu festival, and it's a celebration of beginning of spring, love, new life, good over evil. Throwing the colors represent the concept of equality by everyone, equality by everyone being covered in the same color, signifying the merging of social boundaries, breaking down of social barriers, and everyone being equal under the colorful celebration. That's what the Holi is, actually.
Okay.
And it started with Hinduism, but it has taken over by, you know, India has mixed with so many different Hinduism, Christianity, Muslim, there's so many, Judaism, so many, Buddhism, everybody is there. So we're all celebrated because it's a great celebration. We all can get reminded that we're all equal end of the day.
Well, and you said there in the description a little bit that it sort of highlights spring, love, acceptance, and it has all of those kind of pieces to it. And the colors, I know that there was a bunch of pictures that went online. Yeah. You've been doing this. This is going to be the third year?
This is going to be fourth year.
Fourth year.
We've been finishing our 4 year as a business owner, the Indian cuisine, on June 14th. So this is the fourth year of the Holi.
Wow, yeah. That's so awesome.
And it's getting bigger and bigger. Last year, we had about 400-500 people came to downtown, and it was a great festival to celebrate in downtown with all the businesses participating, and it was super cool.
So when people are – so let's talk about two things, because there's going to be – you have the sort of the Holi Festival ceremony, which is – almost anyone can be involved.
It's
in
a free
that,
festival.
Right?
Anybody can involve. It's at 9 o'clock at night. We try to do it at 9 p.m. to match the timeline in India.
Right.
Even though actual Holi festival is on March 14th, because it's cold out and things, we moved it to the 24th. So we don't interfere with any other festivities happening in Juno.
I see.
Yeah.
And you encourage people who are going to partake in that and the throwing of the colors to wear white.
Wear white, so then you can see what all the colors you got on. on you, and don't wear cashmere white. Wear white t-shirts or something that you can get color on. You know, just be a child at heart and have fun. That's end of the day. That's what we're trying to do.
And you, I think you explained this once before, but I'm curious. The colors you make,
things. I bring them from India. Okay. Actually, every October when I go to India, I bring back. This time I brought about 13 kilograms of holy.
That's
color.
A lot, right?
It's a lot. I don't know the transition on fans.
Yeah,
how
I don't
many
either.
But 13 kilograms of color. It is made out of cornstarch and food coloring, and I have a feeling that is not going to be enough, counting how many guests we had last year. So we might have to get some rice flour together and some food coloring and cornstarch to mix to make that happen.
Well, I'm just thinking too, because people, whatever they decide to wear, right?
Yeah.
So that they know what's in it. So
cornstarch, food coloring, and rice flour. So it's not going to hurt your skin, but it, you know, because of the food coloring, it's not going to come off of it completely either. But
right.
I have one outfit I wear every year, and it looks super cool.
And it just sort of gets more and more colorful
every
year.
Yeah. More
because I figure like a cotton t-shirt or something.
Yeah.
Just absorb those things over time.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
So
you're being part of something big, you know, it brings everybody together.
Yeah.
And you know, Juno is amazing. Like, we have so many amazing stores downtown that people, you know, our guests can come and enjoy the stores, food, whatever, and then come to the festivity, the free festivities.
Yeah.
And our street, we have Amelga Robotics, ourselves, and Devil's Club. We're all partnered together on every festival we do. You know, Devil's Club is going to have some food that we're going to help them make, and we're going to have their beer, and Amelga is going to make us some fun drink
special
that we're
drink,
gonna holy drink. So we always partner to each other, and super cool.
That's cool. We should mention quickly before we continue on this, there is a Valentine's this Friday, the 14th. There is a special Four Hearts.
That's on Thursday, tomorrow.
Oh,
we're
tomorrow.
Doing the night before. It's a Four Hearts on Franklin. That's also, it's already sold out.
Oh.
It was it was sold out. And it is all the Devil's Club is going to do the appetizer. We're going to do the dinner. And you go to Robotics Take Your Valentine's Day Photo. And the next thing is Amelga doing the nightcap. So we purposely did the night before the Valentine's Day so that individually we can do our own specials.
Oh, for Friday,
for
you can
Friday,
do your own
the actual
thing.
Valentine's Day.
Okay, but that was tomorrow. But unfortunately, if you didn't get in on that, you're sold out.
We'll be doing a lot more coordination of Four Hearts next year. So please watch out for early buy tickets.
Or maybe you could do, you're already doing the Holy Festival in March, but I was thinking of St. Paddy's Day. There's different holidays
There's so
that come
many
up
things
that
we,
you
yeah,
can all put. But
yeah.
It's cool that everybody's partnering together to create opportunities and events that happen downtown so that people can get out and go do stuff, which
Absolutely.
Is really good, especially in the dark of winter.
Yeah,
it's kind of fun. Okay, so we are talking about the Holy Festival celebration. It's going to be happening in March. It's on March 24th.
Yes.
And you also will have
a Bollywood dance
flash mob. Now, I know that people, we were talking just before we went on air, and if people want to get involved, they need to
start now. Like this 5 o'clock, this Sunday, we have another rehearsal, Harbor View, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. We have 25 dancers right now. All ages are welcome, men, women, kids, anybody. We already finishing up on two songs. We have two more songs to go. But if you want to rehearse with us, you need to come to the rehearsal this Sunday.
And I love that it's open to anyone.
Yeah,
and you can just join in and you get to learn a little bit of Bollywood dance. And are you teaching that?
I am teaching it. And I talk about what the meaning of the songs is. We have a lot of fun. We laugh a lot. It's a great time to meet, you know, friends on a Sunday afternoon, evening, actually.
I love that. And if you want to participate, of course, you could probably just show up at Harborview at 5 o'clock on Sunday.
Yes.
But you can also email Nimmy at Nimmy, N-I-M-M-Y, at spicejuno.com and let her know that you want to participate and that you'll be there. And you're so sorry that you didn't get in touch with her sooner.
It's no problem.
But you want to be involved because 25 people, I mean, can you imagine, like, getting like 50 to 75?
No, we did had. Holi Festival was huge. We had a lot of dancers. I don't know exact numbers, but it was more than 50 people, more than 60 people. I want to say at least 100 people.
Because I'm sure that even when you do the celebration, like even if you haven't been in rehearsal, people probably on the side start joining in.
They're all dancing in their hearts.
Yeah, that's so fun. That's so cool. That's
and then we're doing the dance at 8 o'clock and then 8 to 8:30. We're going to have that 30 minutes you get to go change to white, whatever whites you want to wear. So if you're going to come downtown, make a reservation for food, plan your day ahead, come shop downtown. We have an amazing downtown. Come celebrate downtown. You know, plan your day the whole Monday so that you can end with, you go home with lots of color on you.
Because you can also, if you want, you're going to have a dinner.
Oh, yeah. We'll have beforehand. The dinner specials. Yeah.
And other restaurants will also be involved and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, you can just go to spicejuno.com for that information if you want to get dinner before the. But the Bollywood Dance Flash Mob and the Holi Festival Ceremony are both for free.
For free. Anybody can join. We create this festival on a Monday night so that all the businesses, you know, get a chance to have more guests coming into their businesses and seeing things too. So that's why we do it on a Monday night, creating more people coming downtown.
Yeah, that's going to be so cool.
It's super fun.
And I love that you're here early enough that people who may want to participate in the dance can hop on that. Again, you can email Nimi@spicejuno.com or show up to Harborview Elementary this Sunday at 5. Are the rehearsals usually on a Sunday or how often?
Always on Sunday. We've been rehearsing for past 4 Sundays now.
Okay.
So it's, 12 rehearsals on a Sunday. And then we'll catch up on a last week of the night before the rehearsal for the dance.
Yeah.
We'll catch up on a Monday, Tuesday as needed kind of thing. The problem is having the space for 25 dancers.
Or
30, where we go. Harborview was very kind. One of our dancers, Kat, was able to get us the space. So it was amazing. Otherwise, we were squeezing in at the Spice Cafe. I do have one other thing we're doing.
Yeah.
We're doing a fundraising for Meals on Wheels for the Holi Festival. We like to do something every festival. Last festival, when we did the Independence Day, we did a flood residential, Juno resident flood victim relief fund kind of thing. We did a $10,000 raising that, a lot of everybody participated on downtown. And this time we're doing Meals on Wheels, and we really want to support them. And we're partnering with the Downtown Business Association to do it. So
how do people, is that something that people will just donate during the time they're downtown?
No, it has to be before, because we're going to hand a check over to Meals on Wheels organization on the day of the Holi.
Oh, okay. So how do people participate?
They can drop the checks off to spicejuno.com at the Spice Restaurant or JDC office. That's where the Downtown Business Association office is. You can make the checks payable to Downtown Business Association, and then Downtown Association will make a check to Meals on Wheels.
I see. And then hand it to them. Yeah, put it on your memo field. Or if you want to do, can you participate if you don't have a checkbook anymore?
You can bring a cash, and then we take your number, your address. That way we can send a thank you note and everything like that.
What about socials? You got like Venmo or anything for that?
We don't have a Venmo. That's probably a good idea, huh?
So many people, it's just now they just, boom, I want to just Venmo you like $50 right now.
Oh,
but I don't have a checkbook.
I don't have a Venmo. I need to get there.
You need to get a Venmo for Meals on Wheels for your donations. Yeah, I think that would be the way to go.
Yeah, and if you have any questions, please reach out. I'm always at the restaurant or Nimi@spicejuno.com. Give us a call. Happy to assist any way we can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the number down there is 586-1036. It's the Holi Festival Ceremony. It's happening on March 24th. It's a Monday night. You can do the 8 o'clock Bollywood Dance Flash Mob if you want to get involved, or you can just watch.
Yeah.
But if you want to get involved, email Nimi@spicejuno.com. And the Holi Festival Ceremony, which you want to participate in, just wear white. Colors are provided.
Yes.
And that's really so cool. And that is, it's interesting. We were talking at the beginning that it comes from sort of the Hindu tradition, but has become sort of something has morphed, right?
Yeah. Everybody celebrates, everybody part of it. You know, it just brings more joy and happiness to everyone.
I love it. Nimi, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for
being here. I really appreciate it. That's so nice.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, we will talk to the Juno Economic Development Council. The business of AI is the theme at this year's Innovation Summit. But first, here on Juno Afternoon, this week's Tongass Voices, perspectives from the homelands of the Occoquan and beyond. A team of researchers in Alaska have banded together to investigate a famous Alaska shipwreck. The Star of Bengal sank off the coast of Prince of Wales Island in 1908, taking more than 100 lives with it. The shipwreck highlighted stark racial inequality in Alaska at the time, since most of those who died were Asian cannery workers. And now, members of the 2022 expedition to the site of the wreck are going back, and they're going to be going back this May.
I'm Gig Decker, 50-year commercial fisherman from Wrangell, Alaska. And I was a commercial harvest diver for 38 years. And I became interested in shipwrecks 30 years ago, mainly because you run into a lot of that sort of thing when you're commercial harvest diving. And I became interested in the Star of Bengal because I've seen it as a really important aspect of the fishing and processing industry. And I've always been really interested in seeing the story of the Bengal lifted to a point to where I think it deserves in the history of Alaska and the coastal communities.
My name is Jenya Anichenko. I am a maritime archaeologist. I came to Alaska in 2004, first time chasing a Russian shipwreck. And ever since I stayed in the state, I've done a lot of things professionally, but shipwrecks and maritime archaeology remain my passion. I am originally from St. Petersburg, Russia, and I am now proud to say I'm an Alaskan for the last 20 years. It's kind of a mystery. Maybe not so much, but in details it is. We know that out of 36 crew members of the Star of Bengal, about 17 died. And we know that of 106 cannery workers of Chinese, Filipino, Japanese origin, only 10 survived. It's a huge racial disproportion of lives lost. And we're hoping to be able to find out what really happened.
A lot of people don't realize the tremendous involvement that Asian people have had in the development of the fishing and processing industry in the Northwest, and particularly in Alaska. They were the predominant labor force, and there's a fairly clear history of mistreatment of Asians, particularly of the Chinese, taking advantage of them, cheating them, and not giving them the health care and that sort of thing they need. So there's been a long history of this from Sacramento all the way up the West Coast through Alaska, not just in processing and fishing, but in timber and mining and road building. And I've always felt that the Star of Bengal was a marker for this whole thing. I think that what happened that night reflects the way that the Chinese and the Asians were treated in the industry. And I think it's an important hallmark for the history of Alaska that should stand out a lot more.
I've been engaged in several archaeological maritime shipwreck studies. And most of the time they originate from academia. This one, at least to me, came as a community wish, a community desire. It's very important for me to know that this is a community project and we're trying to run it as such. Another thing I want to mention is it's an immigrant story for me and it definitely pulls on my immigrant heart. Immigrant population is vulnerable. Chinese and other Asian workers on the Star of Bengal, they were not welcome to this country at all. They had to work really hard, take the jobs that nobody else would take, work for virtually nothing, and risk their lives to eventually feel home in this country. And it's a really important aspect for me, and I think it's an important thing for all of us to remember, especially today, what immigrant story in this country really is like.
is really important because the record needs to be set straight about what happened that night. And anything that we can bring to light out there, I think is going to be really important.
That was this week's Tongass Voices, all about the shipwreck of the Star of Bengal. We are back after some technical difficulties. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. We'll be right back. Up next, we will talk with the Juno Economic Development Council about this year's Business of AI, the theme for the Innovation Summit. But first, let's continue our journey into the Seabank Chronicles. For more, visit the Seabank Chronicles at thealaskatrust.org/Seabank Chronicles podcast. This is Logbook 1, Transmission 3, a map in four dimensions.
You've reached the Seabank Chronicles, a natural sound theater transporting you through the living science of Southeast Alaska. Produced by the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust. This is Beth, your radio operator. We live in extraordinary times, where science and mystery meet in a swiftly changing world. To enter the Seabank Chronicles, just keep listening. Logbook 1, Transmission 3, a Seabank map in four dimensions. 1212, do you have your compass and field guide? In this transmission, your instructions are to comprehend the Seabank ecosystem. You'll need one other tool, a timepiece. Hold on to your hat, it's windy today. Start by taking a look to your left. A forest of evergreens rises over berry bushes and damp, fungi-laced soil. To your right, a muskeg stippled with ponds, shrunken pines, and hillocks of moss. A river rushes past alders to an estuary awash with nutritious sediments. And in the distance, the ocean, where all life resides in saltwater. Don't forget the mountaintops, where almost nothing lives except life-giving glaciers. The Seabank is a mosaic. Can you confirm? This three-dimensional view bursts with life from surface to sky, but the Seabank has a fourth dimension too, time. 20 million years ago, sugar maples and walnut trees built forests here. Now, Sitka spruce and western hemlock do that work. What about shorter-term fluctuations? Salmon fill the rivers in August, but in April are nowhere to be found, absorbed into the trees. As for that breath of wind carrying pollen and spores, it comes and goes in the blink of an eye. Scientists use words like spatial, temporal, and dynamic to communicate that ecosystems are always changing, altered across the landscape by shifts in natural phenomena, topography, even living things themselves. The term succession refers to the path of change a particular environment follows. Take a field of gravel left in the wake of a receding glacier. Rock-hugging lichens are the first to move in, followed by tenacious herbs like fireweed and horsetail. Sun-loving alders, willows, and black cottonwood grow as soil accumulates, soon replaced with stands of dense spruce that chase everything else away with the threat of darkness. After 200 or 300 years, a mix of spruce and shade-tolerant hemlock has settled in, shaping an environment with enough light and nutrients for bushes and herbs, mosses and lichens, fish and birds and insects, and mammals of all sizes to flourish. witness the old-growth forest of Southeast Alaska, among the largest and oldest forests remaining in all the world. Scientists use words like uneven or heterogeneous when describing old-growth forests because they contain vegetation in a diversity of species, sizes, and ages, each contributing its own unique form of assistance to help the wider community persist and thrive. What happens next? The ancient seabank forests we know today endure in what scientists call dynamic equilibrium, a state of balance amid constant change, thanks to an unlikely ally, wind. While gentle forest winds arise and fall away in seconds or minutes, wilder, storm-worn parcels blow for hours or days. Individual trees fall in sodden soils or snap in half where fungal colonies bloom, opening circles of canopy to the sky. Sunlight pours through the gaps and dormant seeds sprout. Stronger windstorms can topple whole stands of trees, resetting the forest clock by hundreds of years. Where you find exceptionally intact old-growth forests, like those in the seabank, you also find animals that elsewhere are rare or even locally extinct, like brown bears, wolves, and salmon. Ancient forests support these species, and these species support the forest. Ecosystem engineers, or keystone species, as scientists call them, are animals with an outsized role in maintaining a habitat's dynamic equilibrium. It looks like we're losing signal. You'll receive more information on seabank ecosystem engineers in future communications. Remember, mapping the seabank can't be accomplished in a single transmission. Indigenous ecologist Robin Wall Kimmerer writes in her book, Braiding Sweetgrass, that knowing the natural world is the work of a lifetime. Explore, greet all you encounter, and speak their names. Visit thealaskatrust.org/podcast for a photo of an old-growth seabank forest and a starter list of its plant and animal species in Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian, and English. Gunish Chish to the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people for stewarding these lands and waters since a time beyond human memory and for sharing them with all who make the seabank home. When in doubt, keep listening to the places where science and mystery meet.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The Innovation Summit, which is organized by the Juno Economic Development Council, is happening February 26th and 27th right here in Juno. It's an event for entrepreneurs, business professionals, thought leaders, and more. This year's theme is topical and is on everyone's mind these days. AI, or the business of AI. For more, you can visit jedc.org/innovation. And today, I have three guests with me in the studio. Yes? One of them is Charlotte Brown, the JEDC Senior Advisor, as well as David and Tyler from Hanson Grass. Gunith Cheesh, welcome. How you all doing? Wasiati. You get a little closer to the microphones, you technologist guys. Guys who work with computers. They're usually behind the screens. They're not usually on the mics. Full disclosure, Hanson Grass is the IT department for KTOO. So it's nice to have you all in the studio. Okay, so let's start with you, Charla.
Sure.
Tell us, I sort of gave a little bit of an intro there about the Innovation Summit, but what is the Innovation Summit and who should participate?
Okay. So the Innovation Summit is it's an annual flagship event that JEDC coordinates, and it is a uniquely immersive experience because it's a day and a half of content that we bring in from experts, and people come and they learn from the main stage. They can present to their fellow summit attendees, so they're sharing cool and innovative projects that they're working on. We'll have at least 30 presentations by attendees, and we have 3 keynote speakers, and we have something called deep dives, and that will be an opportunity as people attend and learn throughout the event. We'll have these deep dives where they can go into a breakout session of their choice to delve further into the topics with the same experts in the room that were addressing them from the main stage. And then we have optional tours in the morning. We have a wonderful evening activities happening on Wednesday evening. We have a full dinner. We'll have the Alaska Airlines pitch contest. We'll have the State of Alaska's Innovation Hall of Fame award ceremony.
Cool.
And the pitch contestants will win a cash prize. And this is something we do every year. It always follows this exact same kind of design. And it's not like a conference. It's not pick which ones you want to go to. It's come, be part of it, participate, engage, learn, share, and create even together.
And who should go?
You know, it ranges from the AI curious, business professionals, business industry leaders, elected officials, change agents. We'll have some academics there. It's really the purpose of the Innovation Summit is to increase Alaska's capacity to innovate. And we believe that innovation inspires creativity. It leads to entrepreneurship. It leads to new business ideas. It leads to economic growth. So this is our kind of way to serve Southeast Alaska as well as the state by making this available to people who care about this type of stuff.
I love that. And of course, as I mentioned, you can go to jedc.org/innovation. I love that you call what normally people call breakout sessions. I love that you have a different name for them, deep dives.
Deep dives, yes.
Because you mentioned you have 3 keynote speakers. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about who the keynote speakers are?
Of course. On day one, we will start off with an AI futurist and technologist named Steve Brown. He was formerly with Google DeepMind, and at Intel, he was their chief evangelist, which I didn't even know was a term. I had to look it up. It's like where marketing and technology like meet. And so he's going to share with us kind of the opportunities that AI presents in the context of business, as well as kind of share his perspectives as an entrepreneur. And then our second keynote later that day, her name is Kate Arthur. She is coming to us from Montreal, Canada. And she has been serving the Canadian government in an AI public awareness working group of professionals who are helping ensure that citizens are informed. She's just released a book called Redefining Literacy in the Age of AI. So she's going to speak to us about kind of these algorithms and these coding behind the scenes, kind of like the stuff you guys already know, but like layperson common terms, and remind us, you know, what it is to be human. And so that's kind of a balance, I think, of the two.
Cool. And then was there a third one?
Yes. On the second day over lunch, we have an executive partner coming to us from Gartner. Her name is Danielle Clapp. She's a former CIO in multiple roles. And she will be she'll be our last keynote. We'll still have stuff on Thursday afternoon, but she'll kind of tie it all together over lunch. In the context of like a strategy, is it right for your business? It's for each at the firm level, each set of leaders to decide. And so she'll kind of speak to that strategy piece.
And each of the deep dives or many of the deep dives, mm-hmm. you'll be able to chat with those folks and
yes.
go deeper into
sure.
different topics and things like yep. that. And then you mentioned tours. What are we going to be touring? I'm just curious.
Yeah. And I can tell you just a little bit about the deep dives. if we have time.
Yeah.
But just quickly. Okay. So right now we have a deep dive called The Human Experience by Industry. And we're kind of looking at it from a policymaker standpoint, a practitioner standpoint, and the entrepreneur standpoint. And we have a series of questions, one for each industry that's common in Alaska. So commercial fishing, tourism, oil and gas, aviation, healthcare, environment, education, government, and arts. And so each table can pick and choose what they want to talk about. And it's really about, like, what is happening? Is it ethical? How is it impacting you? How is it impacting your industry? So it's a safe place to come and have these conversations. We're not pushing AI. We're not pro, we're not con. We're just like, this is happening. And we want Alaskans to be prepared for the future. And so this is a great place to come and learn more. The other one is called, it's a deep dive on the challenges of Alaska's infrastructure. So broadband, connectivity, workforce development, all in the context of AI. And then the tours start off, so the official start time for the event is 1 p.m. on Wednesday, but that morning we have optional tours, and we have three. One is AI in Alaska Science and Technology. We'll be taking people out to NOAA, UAS, and the Marine Exchange of Alaska. And the second one is behind the scenes at the Alaska State Museum, and they will be featuring ancient Alaska Native technologies and innovations. I'll add that Gut Clothing is being inducted into the Hall of Fame that night, so very exciting. And the third tour is called Entrepreneurs on the Edge. You must be 21 or older to participate. And we'll be featuring three successful entrepreneurs. One is Julie Hamilton with Treadwell Herb Company, THC, on Douglas Island. And then we'll go to Drip Drop Wonder Shop downtown and meet with Natalie Weinberg, who's a wonderful artist. Her work is provocative. It's exploratory. It's pushing boundaries. And then the third stop will be Freya Romance Boutique out in the valley, which is a shop that features romantic clothing and accessories.
Cool. Okay. That's awesome. What a full schedule. It's going to be a packed couple of days. So Tyler and David from Hanson Grass, how are you all involved in this?
Sure. Yeah.
Thanks, Tyler. What's up?
JDC has been a client of ours forever. And since the Innovation Summit began, we've been involved with a booth out in the area and, you know, kind of supporting where we can, providing some technical support to the event like we do for various events. Year after year after year, we kind of get pulled in, and we've been sponsors consistently, and this year the topic is the business of AI. In our line of work, that's highly relevant to kind of what a lot of our clients are asking about and what we're thinking about a lot internally in terms of operations and what's next for how we provide service, and all the questions that everybody's asking about AI, especially poignant for us as a tech company. With this year's event, we got pulled in quite a while ago. The JDC staff needed a bit of a primer, I think, like anybody, on AI and language models and what are we talking about. And my partner Jeremy's been attached to the hip to these guys
yes.
for quite a few months now, just kind of helping them drink from the fire hose on all the vocabulary and how to interact with these tools and what they can do, and even some little case studies and stuff, exploring data analysis, this, that, and the other, that's kind of like been the journey to the event. And then when the event arrives, we're a sponsor, and we're sponsoring the Innovation Lounge. And this year the Innovation Lounge is going to look like a little computer lab of sorts. We're setting up a bunch of terminals with the various popular, foundational language models and AI tools.
And each one will be different. And
that's cool.
People can just kind of drive by and hop on a computer and just test it out, kind of like bar height. tables.
Yeah.
So it's like an AI testing station. So well, one will have ChatGPT, and one will have Gemini, and one will have Copilot.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I use Perplexity.ai, which is basically like a Google. It's almost like Google. It's sort of, and what I love about it is it aggregates the information that you're asking for, and it also gives you the sources where it's pulling from, so you can double check it. Now, David, I don't know if you're the guy to answer this question, but I'm going to ask you, and then we'll see. Because it's not really, we don't have time to go into all of the details, but I think one of the biggest misconceptions that is out there about AI right now is the difference between what can be helpful in business versus what most people in the public eye are seeing about AI, which is generative AI, images being created or scripts being created or videos or deepfakes of politicians being created. And that's not necessarily the AI that you all are talking about in terms of business. So can you give me like a little bit of a separation between sort of generative AI and like the business use of AI?
Yeah, I think, and I think for a lot of what we use it for, and I think a Claude Anthropic just released a study and they showed, oh, these are the, we looked at, you know, I can't remember the exact number, it was like 10 million conversations that our agent has had with users, and these are what they're mostly using it for. And it kind of hit what we do too. It's like a, you know, assisting with critical thinking, programming, information retrieval, helping to answer questions. So that's kind of what we're using it for a lot. And I think that's what a lot of our clients are using it for. Like we have a security event and we've got a log with, you know, maybe like 10,000, like an audit log of every event that's happened at a business. And we need to sort through it. And so this thing that can look at it, you know, and contextualize it and try to, you know, think about what it is we need to focus on can assist us with that. And that's, so we're not really using like image generation to, or any of the other, a lot. I think a lot of the way.
Yeah, no, that, and that's what I think most of the public thinks about it a lot of times, because that's what they're seeing being talked about. But what's interesting is, like, to me, what you just described, where you're taking like your 10,000, you know, code errors or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That just seems like computing to me, like that it's just taking the computer's taking the power of putting it into, you know, and getting it into some sort of information that you can then use, as opposed to you all hiring an intern or something to go through 10,000 code errors and try to figure out what is happening, right? So it's like that is where, to me, the biggest difference is between. I think when people hear the term AI, they get afraid of the other stuff, the generative stuff, the deepfake stuff, the politicians. The, you know, they had that robocall of Joe Biden a couple years ago that was fake, right? Mm-hmm. And how can we? Obviously, we need to figure that out too, in terms of figuring out how do we, you know, determine what is real and what isn't. But in terms of this conference and what people are really going to be learning is how can AI be used in a business sense, right? I mean, that's what it's called, the business of AI, right? So that's kind of an interesting topic. Yes, Charla?
Well, I was just going to add that for entrepreneurs and small businesses and nonprofits, this has the potential to make your dollar go so much further in terms of things you wouldn't be able to do because you really don't have enough, you know, that kind of payroll budget to hire as many people as you want to do all the things you need to do. So it helps you like summarize. We've been testing AI products at JEDC, and we've been using a tool that summarizes your meetings. It gives you your action items. It identifies the speakers. And, you know, we often have large meetings with, we're engaging the public. There's a lot of conversation and thought. And what could take hours to summarize now takes maybe somebody like half an hour. Because you have to edit it. You have to review it. It's not 100% accurate. And that's another thing that we'll want to talk about at the conference, at the summit. And that is, you know, AI is not creating new things. It's taking the input we've given it and it's using that. So it's still back to the human being for the creativity and the original thought. And I was just looking at our deep dive topics that we've approved so far. I mean, not deep dive, the innovation shorts, which I did mention. Those are the 10-minute shorts that the attendees are sharing, and we've got a collection that's kind of come together, and the theme for that particular set of sessions is being human. And so we've got Jake Carpenter talking about human ingenuity, and that is really what innovation is. We have a professor from UAS who has a PhD in psychology, and she studies art and aesthetics in terms of like the meaning it brings. And she's preparing a talk about the value of art in terms of like who created it and what's the value we're placing on it. Up in the Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope, they are going to present on how they're empowering rural Alaska using AI, and they talk about it in the context of real estate and housing, and I'm not exactly sure how they're doing it, but they're using it to serve that population. We've got a presenter talking about climate refugees and perhaps coming to Juneau. It's not necessarily AI, but it is that humanity component. And then even at JEDC, we've attached an AI chatbot to our Shrek Coalition webpage, which promotes helping elders in Southeast Alaska gain access to the care that they need. And so anyway, it's really neat to see how these innovations are taking place, and they're serving humanity well.
We're out of time, unfortunately, okay. Charlie. But it's the Alaska Innovation Summit. It's going to be from the Juneau Economic Development Council. You can register and learn all this stuff. The schedule's online. It's so much stuff. You should see all the charts and pages that Charla has in the studio right now. It's a huge conference, and if you're in business, it's the thing to do. Go learn about it. It's going to be happening February 26th and 27th at the Centennial Hall, and you can find out more at jadc.org/innovation. Tyler, David, Charla, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us a little bit about the business of AI. I really appreciate it. Okay, up next, we talk with Brenda Wright from the Juneau Audubon Society about events happening this week, including a talk on Alaska's fisheries and the great backyard bird count. But first, this is A Rich Tradition with Nelson Mandela.
I stand here before you not as a prophet, but as a humble servant.
I'm Yosef Surrett from Columbia University. After his release from prison, Nelson Mandela lived a rich and public life, which was quite a departure from the conditions of isolation in prison. Mandela recalled his very first day.
They lined us up, we were four of us. I was at the back with another comrade, and there were two others in front. And they were very harsh. And then I whispered it to my colleagues, look, we must fight right from the beginning. They must know what type of men we are. We must not give the impression that they can issue instructions as to which conflict with our principles. If they are carrying out the regulations, we will obey that. But where they overstep the limit, we must fight and resist.
Mandela talked about the isolation of prison and how he dealt with those conditions.
To spend 27 years at the prime of your life is a tragedy. And I regret, you know, those years that I have wasted in prison. But there are very positive aspects too, because I had the opportunity to think about problems and to reflect on my mistakes.
One luxury, the opportunity to read.
Especially biographies. And I could see what men, sometimes from very humble beginnings, were able to lift themselves and become international figures. And men were useful to society, in their own community, and to the world.
For A Rich Tradition, I'm Yosef Surrett.
A Rich Tradition was produced by Jim Luce in partnership with WCSU-FM in Wilberforce, Ohio.
AAPRC, the African American Public Radio Consortium.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan AD have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the Tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these Tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. A couple of cool events happening this week involving the Juno Audubon Society, and I'm joined now by Brenda Wright to share more with us. Gunath Chi, Sha'igudi, thank you so much. Brenda, it's good to see you again. Wasa Iti, how's it going?
Good to see you, Boston. Have you had too much sun in your eyes?
I wish. Sometimes I'm stuck in here in the studio. But it's all good. I do love that we're getting some more sun, which means spring is coming, which probably means more birds, right? And also pretty soon, spring walks with the Juno Audubon Society.
That's very correct.
Is tomorrow, so tomorrow, is this the last talk tomorrow?
No, actually, we still have March and April events for the public to enjoy.
Three more talks, and we'll talk about the one tomorrow here in just a second. And then, so the walks pick up in April?
Mid-April,
okay. And of course, you can go to junoaudubon.org, right, to find out all the information and the events tab that they have there for all that stuff that's coming up. But let's first talk about tomorrow's event. Tell us what's happening. There's a talk happening tomorrow.
Yes, indeed, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's the main theme is shorebirds, but the title of it is How Alaska's Fisheries and Science Are Keeping Pace with Changing Conditions by Ebert Siddon. And unfortunately, she wasn't able to come today to be on the radio, but we sure want everybody to enjoy her talk.
Yeah.
She's a NOAA person, and so she has a great deal of data, a fascinating area to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ebet's going to be talking about shorebirds in this talk?
Yes, yes. Because you happen to get to see lots of different things when you're in the ocean or along the shore, shorebirds are actually part of the study.
Oh, okay. That's kind of cool. Yeah. Wonderful scientist. And I think that'll be a fascinating talk. And are the talks, I can't remember, are they made public as well in terms of later? Do you video them?
Yes. Normally we do. I'm not sure if we will for this particular one. But if you want to see anything like Bob Armstrong's very popular one on ravens from last month, it's on the Juno Audubon YouTube station.
Okay.
So you can just go on to YouTube and check for Audubon and find all of our last couple years worth of videos.
I love that. That's a great way to archive, right?
Yeah, well, you know, because we want to share with all the birders in Southeast and not all of them can come to our public meetings.
So that's tomorrow, excuse me, that's tomorrow on the 13th at 6:30 p.m. out at the Egan Lecture Hall, and that's room 112, and of course, open to the public and free of charge.
Yes, indeed.
Awesome. That's so cool. Okay. And then the other event, the exciting event, beyond a talk, of course, a talk is cool, that's is the Great Backyard Bird Count. Tell us about that.
You know, it's such a great name for it because originally they started doing a bunch of study, citizen science study, on just backyard bird feeders. And they found out that it was so fascinating to find out more about the winter bird populations all over North America. And then they thought, well, why don't we just make our backyard bigger, like wherever you want to go, anywhere, and call it the Great Backyard Bird Count. And that way they get a lot more information about the birds that live with us in winter.
Okay. And this is, you can go to birdcount.org and you can find out more information about it. But how do people participate in this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's actually, it's not just a weekend either. It starts on Friday, the Valentine's Day, the 14th, and it goes through Monday, the 17th.
Oh, okay.
And you could, sometimes I try to challenge myself because it's only, you only have to do it for 15 minutes to count, if that's all the time you have. They just want to identify the birds and count them and then submit your information either by eBird or you could send it to me at large, Juno Audubon, and I'll submit it for you if you don't want to do it electronically. But it's really easy. And you can. I challenged myself one time, and I did 8 in one day.
You did 8 15-minute sessions?
Of course. There's a lot more than 15, that many minutes in a day, right?
So you can do it more than once in a day, but
yes.
Just 15 minutes at a time.
Right. But we please, if you can, please do not count the same bird twice.
Right, right. Don't go to the same area, probably.
Right. You have so
to
if you're sitting in your kitchen having a sip of coffee, do not count your bird feeder 14 times the same day.
So when they were doing it originally, you're saying that they were mostly just with folks who had a bird feeder in the backyard,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't do anything electronically or anything.
No.
It was just people manually counting, right?
Right, uh-huh.
Okay.
And so it was a lot different, you know, a little bit like your AI talk. So we're so electronic now, we can get so much more data because it's like having 17,000 scientists helping you collect data on the bird that you're most interested in if you're trying to study like a nuthatch or something.
Yeah. And so what's the importance of the bird count? Why do we need to do it?
Well, for us, especially in the northern climates, we really need to know how well the birds are surviving winter, especially a winter like this where it's a beautiful winter, but everything's freshwater's frozen. A lot of birds that eat seeds, they're hard to find. And so they really want to know what the all around the world, how birds are surviving the winter.
Mm, interesting. Because that then they can help them? Is that what they want to be able to do?
If we don't know which birds are suffering most from different weather thing events or just the types of winters we're having, then we can't help them during migration by protecting places they have to stop for food.
Oh, I see.
So if we had passenger pigeons still, like 700 billion of them, we'd want to keep some wheat fields open for them in the springtime so that they could eat the leftover seeds.
I see. How, I guess, the question I'm thinking of is how invasive do scientists want to get, like in terms of how much do we want to help versus sort of the natural, you know, sort of mm-hmm. survive and, you know.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in the last 30 years, we've lost over a third of all the North American birds.
Yeah.
And so it's very critical now for us to understand the types of habitat that they use most and are most important for their survival.
So we kind of have to step in, right?
Yeah, we can't just let it keep going or we won't have our birds.
Yeah, I see. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, and the birds are a vital part of the ecosystem, right?
And yes, and luckily for us, most of the time, if you're looking through binoculars, you're not really disturbing them much. You can, like the geese now, you know, after hunting season, it takes them a little while to be comfortable with people getting close to them. But if you're looking through binoculars, they'll just keep eating them up because of that. The smorgasbord is only open after the tide has removed the ice off the grass.
Now, not that everybody should go to the same place.
No, no, no.
But where's some of the best bird watching here
bird
in
watching,
Juneau?
You know, most of it's the Mendenhall wetlands right now. Because, like I just mentioned, except for the birds that only eat seeds or something like that, anything that's eating vegetation, they have to go to where the ice is being removed. All the freshwater ponds and lakes are frozen.
But the bird count, really, you want it to sort of be in people's neighborhoods, right?
Right,
so you
right.
can get a good sense of...
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want to just go count geese. You want to check and see that rare chickadee that shouldn't be down here, the black-capped one, you know, should be up in the alpine. It's still coming to my feeder.
That's right. It's the Great Backyard Bird Count. It's happening this Friday through Monday. It's anywhere in the world you can do this, and anywhere you can see birds. You can learn about it at birdcount.org, or you can go to JunoAudubon.org, where you can learn about all the things specific to Juneau, including Ebet Siddon's talk tomorrow, How Alaska Fisheries and Science Are Keeping Pace with Changing Conditions, out at Egan Library at 6:30 p.m. That's tomorrow, Thursday the 13th. Brenda, thank you so much for coming in. Gunnith Cheech for telling us about it, and happy bird counting this weekend.
Thank you.
That was do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, we feature Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations. Our guest is Alaskan author and Pulitzer finalist for The Snow Child, Eowyn Ivey. And we spoke on the eve of the publishing of her new novel, Black Woods, Blue Sky. It's a full hour on her new book, her writing process, and more. Eowyn Ivey, tomorrow here on Juno Afternoon, which airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. The show is sponsored in part by Heritage Coffee and Hanson Grass. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh! We'll be right back.